We're focusing on probably some of the most important things that you can ever get hold of. Unfortunately, it's very hard to get it across to the masses, I mean, to the people, because everything has to be so, in the minds of the people, so completely fleshly. I was thinking yesterday, in the wedding we attended, how much dependence there was on human factor to hold the marriage together. Every little thing that was done to be sure that people understood that they were really, really, really going to make it. I've always said that vows are like restaurants. No restaurant's better than the last meal you ate there. No vow's any better than your last failure. Humans get self-confident, I think. I don't mean to eliminate all fleshly efforts to worship or to hold on to Christ, but the great difference, and we started talking last week in this vein, great difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament was the difference between the flesh and the spirit. That's where you have to nail it down, because all the worship activities were flesh-oriented. I mean, you have to realize they didn't have the Spirit in the sense that we do today. The Spirit hadn't come yet. When people in the modern church attempt to smuggle in Old Testament stuff, it shows they just don't get the picture. I was thinking of that yesterday and listening to that wedding service. The minister, I was just thinking to myself, he just doesn't get it. And I thought to myself, well, this must be a novice. Or it must be maybe someone that they got from the wedding chapel. It turns out that he was a very long-standing pastor of a church and highly recommended by many. I thought it was a novice. I don't know that I've been to many weddings where they do know what it's all about. But the key point here is this matter of worship. And remember that Jesus told the woman of Samaria, they that worship the Father must worship in spirit and in truth. And in effect, that story in the fourth chapter of John really puts a finger on the ultimate issue of the New Testament. Most people don't see it that way. Nor is it an appeal for racial tolerance, because of course that is one of the things they like to use it for, because, you know, as I said to you, the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans at all. They out racist the racists. They wouldn't even pass through the land of Samaria to get to Galilee, which is just on the other side of Samaria. Though instead they went clear down to Jericho, quite a run from Jerusalem to Jericho. They saved themselves a lot of miles, when miles meant something. But Jesus went plowing right straight through. I don't think there's any passage that shows more function of Christ to cut right through to the heart of the issues. He said he must go through Samaria. What he encountered in Samaria, which apparently was what he intended to encounter, was this woman of extremely questionable history. He knew where he was going. He knew who he wanted to talk to. You think he could have sat down with a priest or something? He could have dealt with the upper echelons of the society. But he went right to the core of it. To a woman who had a very checkered past, he went to the core of the message with this woman. Here's a simple woman out at the well. Not that women are all simple, you understand. I'm not saying that, but this woman was apparently a fairly simple woman coming out to draw water. So he sat on the well to ask her for a drink. And then he told her, I would have given you living water. He launched right into the most essential element of the whole Christian message. She says immediately, well, what are you going to get water with? You don't have anything to dip with. It's a deep well. What are you going to do? Well, he said, he that drinks of this water will thirst again, but he that drinks of the water I shall give him shall never thirst. The Greek word says never forever, never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. Now imagine saying that to a simple Samaritan who wasn't even in tune with the Jewish message. I mean, she was not far away from it. The Samaritans practiced their own brand of worship and so forth. So it wasn't a total pagan. But he's telling this woman at a well in Samaria something that even Nicodemus didn't understand. And he might have said, well, if Nicodemus didn't understand it, how can I say that to this woman? But he said it. She said, you know, how are you going to give me this water? And then he said, he that drinks of this, of the water I will give will never thirst. Now that is a very sweeping statement. It comports with the thing I keep telling you, that once you take Christ into your spirit, he's there. He's not going to run out on you. I said this morning, if somebody's telling you're backsliding, they're sliding right along with you. They wouldn't know you were there. He says, not ever thirst again. The Greek word or phrase is very emphatic. Not at all, ever. People assume that the Spirit comes and goes with the tide. No, he's there. And how happily you can tell people, don't give up Christ. Don't give up on yourself. He says you'll not ever thirst. It's very similar, of course, to John 7:37, where he says, where it says he stood and cried, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believeth on me, as the scripture said, out of his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water. She said, well, you know, I'd like some of that water that I never have to come back here and draw. She didn't say, oh, that's a marvelous insight into the scripture. She didn't say that. You know, simple soul. Hey, great. Where's that water you have? And he said, well, go call your husband. She said, well, I don't have a husband. He said, yeah, that's right. You've had five. The one you're living with now is not your husband. And in that, you said the truth. Now, in a lot of sermons, they're going to stop there and supply a large measure of human perdition. They will say, the minister's going to say, well, you see, now Christ couldn't give her that water until she confessed her sins and took care of her past. Well, that's a big insert. Not uncommon in the clergy today to make inserts. He didn't say, wait a minute, before you go, how are you going to straighten out this mess? And say that. Well, she was a little startled. And she said, wait a minute. You must be a prophet. Very important. She said, wait a minute. I got a question for you. Not how am I going to straighten out my life. Her question was, where should we worship here in Jerusalem? Theological question. Here's this woman who's facing a pretty critical charge, who is so little threatened by it that she moves on to a theological question. She apparently doesn't get, you know, shaken by it. She doesn't say, I'm sorry. She doesn't say, what shall I do about it? She declared the case, what was true. Jesus said, yes, right. And then when she asked the question, what would the average minister today respond to her when she would ask that question? I know what he'd respond. Don't dodge the issue. You're a sinner. Yes, but, well, you better get your life straightened out. Oh, I know, but that's a little difficult. No, they wouldn't have let her go on to a theological question. Don't dodge the issue. It doesn't matter about that. What matters is you. Well, he didn't say anything of the kind. I think you have to see the impact of that sort of thing. Not that the Lord is soft on sin. I think he's soft on sinners a little bit. No, but not that he's soft on sin. But it is that there are other issues there that are critical than the issues at that point of human interactions. See what I'm saying? All right, you screw up your life, so let's go on to something more positive. I want you to remember something and remember it well. Your brain is so interlaced with trillions of nerve paths, of neurons, interlaced, interconnected, layer upon layer, interconnected layers, that it's hopeless to go back and try to sort it all out. Pull those threads out of there. People are forever trying to go back and sort through all that stuff, bring it out in the open so they can deal with it. By then, they've short-circuited the entire system. You can't do that. You can be penitent. You can realize the magnitude of the life, or whatever it's been, or the sins, and give it to Christ. You confess it, you put it behind you, and you go on. I know several cases I've talked to within the last week or two. Same statement. I just want to get it behind me and go on with my life. The problem with both of these people was the mixing in their situation with other Christians, keeping them stirred up, kind of pressing them to get everything out in the open. It's the modern or fairly recent idea of inner healing. They're all just a bunch of busybodies fooling around with other people's lives. Get it all out in the open so we can all share in it. It's better than a soap opera. It's a terrible thing to do to people. Christian people in general are just busybodies, nosing around in other people's business. It's a thing with them. It's really sad the way Christians mix it up with other Christians' lives. Leave people alone. As far as the general process of your life, only God can handle that. You can't handle it. They can't even handle their own lives. People who mix with other people's lives always assume they are better than they are. They want to help you because, of course, they're all straightened out themselves. Now they can help you get straightened out to be as good as they are. Back to the woman of Samaria. I didn't really intend to get going down this line, but that's a really important point. He didn't involve himself with her life. I'm not saying he agreed with it, condoned it, or anything else. It just wasn't that vital at that moment to get in mixed with it. And it did not keep him from making his contact with her. And it did not keep him from suggesting to her that she worship God in the Spirit. Now, your average minister would have said, well, before you can really worship God properly, you're going to have to straighten out your life. You know? He didn't say anything like that at all. He didn't think she was not in a position to worship in the Spirit. He said, well, I'll tell you, don't worry about here or there. If you're going to worship God, you've got to do it in the Spirit. He didn't really stop and explain all that even. But it's amazing that he picked this woman up in Samaria to be the entree into the Samaritan society. And then she went back to the village, brought her gang out with her, but she said to him, come and see this fella, because he told me all things that ever I did. A little exaggerated there. She didn't say, and I know I'm a guilty sinner. She just said, that's what he did. And they come on out and hear him. Isn't this the Messiah? So they all went out there, large numbers of them went out. I don't know how many number of them went out and listened to Jesus. But can you see the, what shall I say? It's always an amazing thing in the Bible. And Paul caught it. He picked up on it. 1 Corinthians 1. He made it very clear that the Lord has chosen the weak of the world to confound the mighty. It's so vintage Jesus. It's so like him to pick this Samaritan woman to be his contact point in Samaria. And Samaria had quite a history. I won't go into it tonight, but they were overrun. They were part of the northern 10 tribes, and they were overrun by, well, first by Ashurbanipal, and then by Sargon II, B.C., of course. Somewhere around 721, Samaria fell to the Assyrians, and they replaced segments of the population, transferred people of Samaria over to Babylon and brought Babylonians in there. So it was quite a mix of religion in Samaria. But it's prophesied in the book of Micah, the recovery of the Samaritans. Incidentally, remember there's a difference between Samaria and Sumeria. Sumeria was a civilization that was contemporary with the old Egypt, ancient Egypt. 2000 B.C. even antedated it a little bit. And the Sumerians are the basis or are, you know, the substance of the Phoenicians. When they were the inventors of the wheel, the inclined plane, they built these great ziggurats. That was a different bunch. That was, and the Samaritans were part of the northern 10 tribes of Israel. Great difference. They came much later. Well, anyway, here's a major movement. Just get this. A major movement in the process of redemption, of the recovery of Israel. And Jesus picks this woman of Samaria. She was nothing like Deborah of ancient Israel. She wasn't a great figure. We live in a world of extreme miniaturization. We're getting things smaller and smaller. Greater the power, the smaller the unit of power. That's the way we're going with it. We're learning the chaos theory, that our old ideas that everything was neatly patterned are getting shattered. Things aren't so neatly patterned. Shapes and sizes and so forth are not geometrically simple. But anyway, be all as it may. In the scripture, you have the same process, but it somehow escapes the leadership of the church. They're in the maximizing of things. They think bigger and bigger and bigger is better. According to Christ, smaller and smaller is better. He loves to take the simple things of the world and magnify them, multiply them. 5 loaves and 2 fishes. What are they among so many? Well, give it to me. I'll show you what they are among so many. But, you know, it's amazing in our operation, people all around the country get touched by this little small operation. And it's interesting with a priest who, whom we meet with rather regularly, had very severe problem in his shoulder of a rotator cuff there, and he had to have surgery on it. But I hadn't seen him for a couple of weeks, and I got a letter from his sister in Des Moines. I went to see him, and he said, well, I just would feel a lot better if you knew I was having the surgery and you would be praying for me. And he has come a long way. From the first days we talked, when he was pretty, despondent, I would say. You know, he had left the Catholic Church and was sort of afloat. You know, he was just out on a raft in the middle of the ocean, as far as he was concerned. Didn't know where he was going or what he was doing. It took quite a while to work with him and get him out of the Catholic slant, which is all religiously oriented, you know, and you've got to follow the church line and so forth. But the Lord likes to do these things. Take the small things so that humans can't get any credit for it. And Paul says that, that no one should boast in himself, in his own abilities. And he sure put us through a lot of things like that. I think I'll knock it off here, but it's a remarkable story, and so like the narratives of the Gospels in that respect.